Well, I'm feeling a little guilty here. It's Catholic guilt, so that's a good thing. But I realize I'm about to give another serious talk on a comedy, so, you know, it makes a man uneasy. So, as I said in the earlier conferences, comedy is not about jokes, though jokes can be a part of comedy. So here are two priest jokes. Okay. So you get a probing, little throat clearing down front. And they're both Irish jokes. So being Irish, I can tell this on myself. So an Irishman goes to his parish priest and says, "Oh, Father, me dog Fido died. He was my companion for so many years. Such a good dog, and it's a terrible loss to me. Sure, now would you say a mass for him?" The priest says, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Don't you know anything of your own faith? 'Tis an animal. Yes, he was your companion, but we only say masses for the repose of dead souls, and those are human souls. What are you talking about?" "Oh, I'm sorry, Father. I should have thought of that. I suppose, well, maybe I'll go down the road and ask the Protestant preacher down there. Maybe he'd say a few prayers for him." "Yes, you go and do that now. Now, Father, do tell me, though, do you think that £500 would be enough to give him?" "Well, good gracious, man, why didn't you tell me your dog was Catholic?" Very fond of that. A young Irish revolutionary goes to confession. He goes into the confessional and says, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It is 6 months since my last confession. And Father, I've done a terrible thing. "What is it, my son?" "Oh, you know, all those railroad tracks that were blown up all around here. Father, I'm the one that did it. I bought the explosives. I set them on the tracks. I blew up all those railroad tracks, Fathers. I'm the one. "Oh, son, it's a terrible thing you've done. It's a terrible thing. But I can tell you to repent, and you've come to confession, so I will forgive you through the power of God that has been given to me. Now, for your penance, I want you to do the stations." So there. Let me start again with the title, which you'll notice, and it's unusual, Twelfth Night has two titles. It's the secondary title, the or title, that puts it in a direct line with the ones that have come earlier that we've talked about. Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, that would set it directly in line with the previous two. And indeed, they were written in sequence. Probably 1598, Much Ado, 1599, As You Like It, What You Will, 1600. But the primary title by which this comedy is known is Twelfth Night, or What You Will. Twelfth Night is different. It's not the same as those two earlier titles. Both of the titles can be instructive and help us understand what's going on in the comedy, what the play is about. Twelfth Night is an obvious reference to the 12 days of Christmas. And we know for a fact that the play was premiered and performed during the Christmas holidays. So there is that connection to it. At one point, Sir Toby, when he's drunk, starts singing a song on the 12th day of December. That song, he probably gets the words wrong, he's drunk, and as with many drunken singers, they can't remember the lyrics properly. He's probably singing on the 12th day of Christmas, My True Love Gave. Okay, that's probably what he's beginning. And you'll see productions where they insert that song at that point. Makes a kind of sense, okay? So again, it may well be that the play itself is meant to be set. Now, there's a reference to Midsummer Madness. There is the title of the play. We're not sure exactly what time period. But the reference is clearly a reference to the festival of Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas, but Twelfth Night is the end of the festivities. It's the time when the joyous partying and the festivities draw to a close. It's also the point at which, as with any good time, there's probably been some excess that's gone on, and now that excess has caught up with one, and it's time to return to the real world and daily life and get back to work. Twelfth night also is clearly connected to the Feast of the Epiphany. The Feast of the Epiphany has any number of ramifications, but I would guess, this is my guess, that Shakespeare is using the reference here in terms of seeing clearly and correctly, seeing the truth where others are misled or not understanding clearly, i.e., the kings arrive and present their gifts to a baby lying in a manger in the little town of Bethlehem? How is this possible? It's possible because they have been given a particular grace from God that allows them to see very clearly in that baby the Savior of the world that's been born, the King of Kings. They bring him the Epiphany has to do with seeing clearly. One of the difficulties in this play is people do not see clearly, themselves or others. There are all sorts of cases, you've seen the production, the BBC production, all sorts of cases of mistaken identity. One person thinking, you know, I'm dealing with this person, it's not that person, terrible confusion, who is whom, what's going on here, and this case of, many cases of mistaken identity, lead to all sorts of confusions and troubles, serious troubles. Once again, the tensions can lead to a kind of social chaos. What's going on here? Now, the other problem is the inability to see oneself clearly, to know who I am. And that is a matter of turning one's eyes on oneself and being able to clearly admit who you are, what it is you're after. We're a little touch of As You Like It here, but that brings us to the subtitle of the play, What You Will. And in this play, this last of the great festive golden Shakespeare comedies, we have a whole host of very willful people. Their wills are very strong. They are very strong-willed. They are willing certain things to an extreme degree, but what they are willing and what the will is set on is not healthy for them nor for the social world in which they live. Okay? In fact, in almost every case, with only a couple of exceptions, and it's the exceptions that will finally bring health to this world, the main one being Viola, a very healthy young woman who is discovering and coming to know who she is. But most of the others, when she arrives in Illyria, these people are willful, and their wills are directed in a wrong direction. And they've created a situation where they are isolated, trapped, controlled by their own willfulness, and as a result, the society in which they live has no future, is deadly, and will wither unless that willfulness, that selfishness, that misdirected will, that misapplied will, can be broken away, and there can be a recognition, a clear-eyed recognition of the other. Let me go to the second great commandment. And thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It means there is a measure of self-love. One needs to indeed take care of oneself. One has been given life, a soul, a personality, certain gifts from God. And therefore, one should love the self in terms of this self is a gift from God who gave me this soul, this body, this person, and that's important and good. But beyond that, I'm to love my neighbor as myself. I'm to look at the other and see someone there I can love in the same healthy way I should love myself. But to do that, it means breaking out of the self, going beyond the self. The characters we meet at the beginning of Twelfth Night are isolated and filled with excessive self-love. And it is we begin this play in a dangerous situation. Take a look, if you will, at the very opening speech. First speech of the play. Shakespeare presents it right off the bat. Just as in a well-written essay, you give your thesis or basic points in the opening paragraph, Shakespeare is writing here at the top of his game and gives us the major themes right away in the opening of the play. It's page 85 here, okay? It's Duke Orsino. We come into the play and we meet the Duke of Illyria, high-ranking nobleman, okay? He gets the first speech. There's music playing in the background. Other lords are attending him. One of Shakespeare's most famous lines, right from the get-go, if music be the food of love, play on. It's a wonderful line, okay? But please notice what happens here. We are already, in the first line, confusing appetites and using a metaphor of music, which should enter the ear, with food that enters the mouth, okay? With this strange mixture of appetites. If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it. Excess of food, it's called gluttony. It's a sin. It is very difficult, and it's a habit one can fall into, of excess. Excess is not good in any sphere other than excess of love of God. Well, we can't love God too much. We can't love our neighbor too much. So it's not excess, okay? Excess is a danger. Give me excess of it. That, surfeiting, the appetite may sicken and so die. What? Here's an idea. I have a problem with gluttony, therefore I'm going to eat so much that I make myself physically sick and die. Now he's talking about music feeding his love, but notice the language Shakespeare is using, suggesting something's not quite right with this guy. This is not a healthy notion, and please notice, if he's talking about love, he's not talking about the other, he's talking about filling himself up so that he can surfeit on love, get an excess of love. Why? Because he loves the feeling of being in love, and the music makes him feel more and more like he's in love, and it's a wonderful feeling, but it's almost overwhelming, so give me so much of it that I'll get sick and I will die and there'll be no more love. In three lines, Shakespeare is presenting us with a troubled human being. And this troubled human being is the Duke of Illyria, where the play is set. If the leader of your society is in trouble, then you better believe the whole world in which you live is going to be in trouble, because the leader defines things. The Duke is a troubled man. That strain again. The music comes again. That strain again. But notice it's not that tune again. That melody again. Now, strain means a bit of melodic music, but what does the word also suggest? This Shakespeare in this play is the master poet. No word is here accidentally. That strain, excess. I mean, the language is just, it's too much. That strain, again, it had a dying fall. It's a musical term. It's a falling cadence. But for the second time in four lines, he's mentioned death. Oh, it came o'er my ear like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing and giving odor. Enough, no more. 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. Peremptory. Give me more music. Give me more music. Give me more. I don't want more music. What you will. This is willfulness. Willfulness. 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. O spirit of love. Please notice, he still hasn't mentioned the lady. O spirit of love, how quick and fresh art thou, that notwithstanding thy capacity, receiveth as the sea. Love is like the sea. Please notice, this play is a wash in the sea. Here's the first sea reference. And what it has to do is that the spirit of love receives things the same way the sea receives things. We're going to find out in the next scene how the sea receives things. The shipwreck, the nearly drowned Viola, the nearly drowned Sebastian, the separation of brother and sister, the ruined voyage. The sea is dangerous. Spirit of love, notwithstanding thy capacity, receiveth as the sea. Naught enters there of what validity and pitch soe'er, but falls into abatement and low price, even in a minute. Love is like the sea. You can take something that is, I am going to buy a bottle, a little bottle, of the very finest French perfume that costs $5,000 an ounce. Okay? I'm now going to take it. This is very valuable stuff. This little ounce of perfume is very valuable stuff. I'm now going to take it and pour it in the sea. Is it still worth $5,000? Please notice what happens. It's now worth nothing because the sea has received it and that magnificent, expensive little ounce of perfume has been absorbed by the sea and been made valueless. What Orsino is saying is the spirit of love is like that. I heard this beautiful music, but my love is so great, it just absorbed it and overwhelmed it. Now it's gone. Meaning I need what? Something new. Something new and exciting. Not a healthy love. Not a healthy love. Now, we finally find out who he's in love with. It's the Lady Olivia. Okay? Oh, when mine eyes did see Olivia first. There we are, seeing, epiphany, seeing. When mine eyes did see Olivia first, methought she purged the air of pestilence. That instant was I turned into a hart, a deer, and my desires like fell and cruel hounds ever since pursue me. My desires are chasing me the way the hounds will chase a deer, meaning my desires will do what to me? Rip me to pieces and kill me. How now? What news from her? Now we find out about the Lady Olivia. So please, my lord, I might not be admitted, but from her handmaid to return this answer. The element itself, the sun, the element itself, till 7 years' heat, shall not behold her face at ample view, but like a cloistress she will veiled walk and water once a day her chamber round with eye-offending brine, all this to season a brother's dead love, which she would keep fresh and lasting in her sad remembrance. We're going to learn early on that she lost her father, was put in the care of her brother, and then her brother died almost immediately afterwards. And her response is to say, I'm going into mourning. I'm not leaving the house for 7 years. And I'm going to walk around the house weeping every day for 7 years, watering my brother's remembrance with my tears. Now, no matter how important you may think you are, would you want anyone to mourn you for 7 years and stop living? Mourning is real. Mourning is a process. Loss is a very difficult thing. But what we would want from those we love is that they work through the mourning and are able to continue with their lives and go on living. If someone announces, no, I'm going to mourn for 7 years, that is willfulness. That's not about the one who is lost. That's about me presenting to the world how deep my grief is. Here's how profoundly I feel. Watch me cry. And I'll cry again tomorrow for you. And I'll cry for 7 years for you. Excess. It's a play of willful excess. Okay? And indeed, when we meet her, she's wearing black. She's veiled. She's weeping. She's mourning her brother. Okay? I'm going to run through the other excesses fairly quickly. Sir Toby Belch's is obvious. He's a drunk. His willfulness is towards an excess of alcohol. And also, we learn, an excess of food. There's a wonderful moment when he comes into his niece in scene 5 to talk to her. And the first thing that happens is, appropriately named, Sir Toby Belch. I can't belch on cue. I wish I could. He lets out this huge eruct, which is a very fancy word for a belch. He lets his huge and then says, oh, a plague of this pickled herring. Obviously, always gives him gas. But he knows it, and he won't stop eating it. And at the same time, we learn he's just drinking. Okay? That is simple gluttonous appetite. He's eating and drinking to profound excess. Poor Sir Andrew Aguecheek, pathetic creature that he is, has no self-knowledge at all, an excess of self-regard, and honestly believes he can woo the Lady Olivia and she would give him a second look? Poor, pathetic creature. He's ill-educated. Whatever he claims he can, he claims to be a great dancer, he claims to know languages, he claims to be a fencer, he knows nothing. He's an absolute imbecile who takes himself very seriously and out of an excess of self-regard and a total failure of self-knowledge, he's being bilked by Sir Toby, who keeps saying, get more money. Get some more money. Oh, no, I'll make sure you marry my niece, but get some more money. Also means, in his foolishness, he's put his trust in somebody who is using him. Let me say this, and I don't want to overemphasize this. It'll come up a couple of times during this talk. There is some profound sadness under this play. Okay? It's a very funny play. It's a great comedy, but there's some sorrow here. If you have people who understand themselves, know themselves in such a tiny way, and you see how they're living their lives, this is sad. There's some sadness here. Sir Andrew is very funny. I mean, but we're laughing at him, not with him. And at the end of the play, when Sir Toby finally turns on him and tells him what he really is, it's painful. Sir Toby tells the truth, but this is the only friend Sir Andrew has had who's now... There's some sorrow here. There's some real sorrow here. Malvolio. One of Shakespeare's great creations. The name is Italian for ill will. What you will, Malvolio wills ill. He is above everybody. He is superior to everybody. His willfulness is pride of the highest order. And even Lady Olivia says to him early in the play, you are sick of self-love, Malvolio. In that way, he's a bit like Orsino. But Orsino at least thinks he's in love with someone outside himself. Malvolio is just now, notice, Malvolio also will claim to be in love with the Lady Olivia. That terrible trick that's played on him, where he makes a complete fool of himself, is based on the fact that he believes she can love him, does love him. In a way, he's a higher class version of Sir Andrew, but they're both foolish. They both behave foolishly. With this difference, Malvolio will bring himself down into the depths and turn on everyone around him. Everyone around him. He ends the play by cursing everyone. Okay? He's done it to himself. But Malvolio is the character at the end of the play who cannot be part of the social group. At the end of The Merchant of Venice, it's Shylock the Jew. At the end of Much Ado About Nothing, it's Don John the Bastard. At the end of As You Like It, it's Jaques the Cynic. And at the end of Twelfth Night, it's Malvolio the Puritan. And we learn he's able to be judgmental and judge everybody around him and look down on everybody around him because he's a Puritan, he's better than they are, he's higher than they are, and as a result, he is godlike and can pass judgment on everyone around him. And what we discover is he's really in it for himself. Love for the Lady Olivia, hoping to marry her, not for her good, not for the sake of a real marriage, but so he can rise from steward to be lord of the household and really condemn everyone. He wants power. He's after power. Shakespeare knew very well he was surrounded by Puritans, that their ultimate goal was to seize power. In 1642, they did. The English Civil War. And they got it. And in revenge, one of the first things they did was close the theaters. Undoubtedly so, plays like Twelfth Night couldn't be presented anymore, in which there is a Puritan, and it's not a very nice portrait. But what Malvolio wants is to make sure no one ever again has any fun. So while the play is pointing out there's excess here, and terrible excess, and one has to be careful about it, the play is still saying it's possible to have fun. You can go too far, excess, to the point where you destroy yourself, or you can go too far in saying no one can ever have fun ever again, unless I allow it. It's a wonderful moment when Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, and Festy the Clown, two of them are drunk, Festy just likes singing songs, it's late at night, and they begin singing around, okay? And they're making a raucous noise, and in comes Malvolio, furious. They're singing late at night. I suspect if it happened here, there'd be trouble, okay? It's not the sort of thing you do. And it's not so much he's telling them to be quiet, it's his attitude. They don't like him. He's not really concerned about the good of the household or the Lady Olivia. He's concerned. They woke him up. And Sir Toby turns on him. It's one of the great lines. Dost thou think because thou art virtuous there shall be no more cakes and ale? And Festy the Clown says, aye, and ginger shall be hot in the mouth too. Just because you're superior and a Puritan and condemning everybody else doesn't mean we're not going to party. Human beings are going to eat their cakes and drink their ale and eat little bits of ginger and enjoy it and sing songs and do a dance. It's going to happen. Even though you go, I condemn all of you. Okay. It's the Puritan vision. The true story, this occurs to me, I'll tell this story, I won't name names. A conservative writer, doesn't write much anymore, he's very old now, conservative writer, who during World War II was in the German concentration camps. The war ended, and the Soviets got him and sent him to the Gulag. So he went from the German concentration camps to the Gulag, spent some years there, finally made his way out of the Gulag, left Europe, and got a teaching job in Oregon. And he went all the way to Oregon, settled into the teaching job, and discovered he was in a dry county. You couldn't buy alcohol. Not a beer, not a bottle of wine. This means Puritans. Okay? And he said, and it's one of my favorite lines, when I have nightmares, he said this years later, when I have nightmares, it's not about being in the German concentration camps or the Gulag. It's that I'm back in that dry county in Oregon. America is a Puritan land. There are outbreaks of this constantly. But I mean, if you know the great John Ford film, The Quiet Man, where John Wayne comes back from America and he's being driven around. It's Barry Fitzgerald. And he's driving the car and America, he says, America. Prohibition. Yes. I mean, we actually did it. There was a national law against having a glass of wine. It's just the current fad, of course, is this smoking insanity. Insanity. It's quite legal to kill your baby in the womb, but God forbid you're in a public building and light up a cigarette. This is madness. This is madness. The Puritan attitude is if you see anyone anywhere having a good time, you have to stop it at once. Now, these things create each other. The excesses on one side create the excessive restraint on the other side. Okay? So in a way, the excesses of Illyria have created the excesses in Malvolio, but this is not a healthy society. And all of them, are somehow trapped in some way. Malvolio is about the only one on that side, but boy, is he a looming presence. All the others are excessive on the other side. And this is deadly. The images of death at the beginning are not accidental. I want to read you let me put it this way. We have two characters in the play who have found a middle ground. At least the beginning of the play. Have found a middle ground. One of them, of course, is Festy the Clown. He's the fool. He's referred to as the clown, but he is a very, very wise man. I got to say, a little pause before I get to him. The comic characters in Shakespeare, in the early comedies, are very like Dogberry the Constable and Much Ado About Nothing. They're not real bright. Launce in Two Gentlemen of Verona. Lancelot Gobbo in The Merchant of Venice. Dogberry in Much Ado About Nothing. Bottom the Weaver in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Okay, as I said, they were standing behind the door when God gave out the brains. They are not bright. Almost all of them are decent folks, but they're not real sharp. Okay. It's because Shakespeare had a great comic actor, who was apparently brilliant at playing stupidity. His name was Will Kemp. He became a hugely popular star of his day. Everybody loved Will Kemp. So if they went to the theater, new Shakespeare play, they wanted to see Will Kemp, and they wanted to see Will Kemp play stupid. Because he was so funny when he was stupid. Will Kemp became so popular, he took his show on the road. He left London, he left Shakespeare's company, he began touring England, and had a moderate success because he was a big showbiz personality. But it meant Shakespeare's company needed a new clown. Got to have a comic in your troupe, okay? And they hired a man named Robert Armin, A-R-M-I-N, who didn't do dumb. Armin's comedy was not dumb comedy. He didn't play stupid guys. He apparently was brilliant with wit. Quick wit. Firing off good exchanges and getting big laughs in doing it. And suddenly, in As You Like It, the comic figure becomes Touchstone the Clown. In Twelfth Night, Festy the Clown. And the transformation of the greatest of all the witty fools in all of literature, the fool in King Lear. The fool in King Lear. A combination of the witty fools of the comedies and old Adam in As You Like It, who remains loyal to his master and will not desert his master, even though Lear is mad and on the heath. And in fact, I'll mention this later, one of the stanzas, Shakespeare writes a new stanza to the song that ends Twelfth Night. Where does it show up? On the heath in the storm scene in King Lear. The fool suddenly sings another stanza of the song that ends Twelfth Night. Where did this come from? What it means is Armin had a huge hit with that song that ended Twelfth Night. He's now playing the fool in Lear, and Shakespeare gives us a little reminder of it. One more stanza. It's fascinating. We have a whole different kind of comedy. We now have the witty fool who's great with words, who's brighter, who's smarter than the people around him, who can fire off, pop their bubbles, bring them down to earth. Quick little example. Yeah, you saw that. It's a great exchange. First time we see him. He's gone off. He's wandered away. They say, you're going to be in trouble with Lady Olivia because, you know, you left the house. Ah, well, he's back. So he's going to deal with it. And he says, good Madonna, simply means my lady. Okay. It's Italian, Madonna, my lady. Give me leave to prove you a fool. Can you do it? Dexterously, good Madonna. Make your proof. I must catechize you for it, Madonna. Okay. I'll ask you questions. I'll prove you a fool. The Socratic method. Well, sir, for want of other idleness, I'll bide your proof. Good Madonna, why mournest thou? Please notice what he goes to. The core of her problem. Excessive phony mourning. Right to it. Meaning he cares about her. He's trying to wise her up. Good Madonna, why mournest thou? Good fool, for my brother's death. I think his soul is in hell, Madonna. I know his soul is in heaven, fool. The more fool, Madonna, to mourn your brother's soul being in heaven. Take away the fool. Bing, 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 boom! It's magnificent. Just bing, bing. This is a sharp wit. This is a quick wit. But notice what he's doing. He's saying, I'm on to you. This is phony mourning. I'm your fool. I'm here in the household. And what the fool was there for was to bring the high and mighty back down to earth and remind them they're human like all the rest of us. One of the ultimate comic jokes, and one of the reasons for comedy, is to quite literally bring us back down to earth. Hence, the single funniest joke in the world is slipping on a banana peel. Because someone who's upright and proud and walking dignified suddenly is, boom, flat on the back. And that's the reason why, if you should see, God forbid, one of your fellow seminarians cleaning up after dinner, and someone has dropped a banana peel on the floor, and one of your fellows walks by and slips on and goes, boom, boom. Your second impulse will be to go and help and make sure he's not hurt. Your first impulse is what you just did. Because what comedy does is remind us we're human by bringing us back down to earth. And the banana peel does it instantly. What that means is it reminds us that we have bodies, we are part animal, we are subject to the laws of nature, and we are subject to the laws of gravity, among all other subject to everything in the natural world, so don't get too high or mighty, or somebody will have to bring you back down to earth. Another example, it's my favorite example in modern movies. It's a farce. I don't recommend watching it, but it is pretty funny. It's a Western spoof by Mel Brooks called Blazing Saddles that has in it my favorite scene in all of modern comedy. Cowboys sitting around the campfire. There's no sound. It's late at night. They're sitting around the campfire. They've got their tin plates. They've got their spoons. And they're eating beans, as all cowboys have ever done around the campfire since the first movie was ever made. And after they eat beans for a while, the physical fact of beans is put into the movie, and they start raising their haunches and cutting one after another. Because beans cause gas. The human body has to release gas. The reason it's funny is no cowboy ever before in any movie ever suffered the actual chemical consequences of bean eating. And all Mel Brooks did was make us recognize the simple physical chemical fact: you eat beans, you fart. It happens. And it's uproariously funny. John Wayne never did that when he ate beans around the head. When it was first shown on American television, they cut out the soundtrack. It was too offensive for America to watch men eating beans and passing gas. Puritans. So they removed the soundtrack and had them belching. Not funny. You belch when you drink Coca-Cola. You fart when you eat beans. And the scene wasn't funny. Point being, comedy deals with actual physical facts of reality in nature and reminds us we have bodies, we're part animal, and don't get too high and mighty. Now, what the fool is doing is tweaking Lady Olivia to bring her down to earth and forget about her phony grief. It's very good. Now, they're very close, obviously, because they have a wonderful talk. It's when Sir Toby comes in, and he's belching. Eating too much pickled herring makes you belch, okay? So he's had a plague of these pickled herring. And he stumbles out, and Olivia turns to the fool and says, "What's a drunken man like, fool?" She's worried about her uncle. His behavior isn't the best. Like a drowned man, a fool, and a madman. One draft above heat, one draft above heat makes him a fool. The second mads him, and a third drowns him. One draft above heat. You have one drink, and you feel a little warm and tingly. But you're fine. You're yourself. You have that second drink, one draft above heat. One drink more than makes you warm. That is the second drink. One draft above heat makes him a fool. I have the second drink. It's a little bit bigger than the first one. And the next thing you know, I'm putting a lampshade on my head going, okay? The second drink will make you foolish. By the way, somewhere St. Thomas, when asked how much should a man drink, says ad hilari totum. To the point where you're giggling a little bit and it's sort of funny. And then you stop. So maybe the second would be okay. You can put your lampshade on the head and go doy 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 doy. We all have a laugh. But then you better stop. Okay? The second. Now that means the second beyond heat. So it's the third one. Which is guaranteed to be much bigger than the first two put together. Because now we're just pouring. Okay? The second mads him has two meanings. You go on being foolish and you start doing crazy things. No, I can still drive the car. No, give me the keys. I'm fine. No problem. I can drive the car. Or the other meaning of mad, the barroom brawl. I don't like your looks. Quite literally. Suddenly, anger starts bubbling up, and it's why bars are places of contention, where men who have had too much to drink start fighting. What the fool is saying here is absolutely correct, but please notice what it is. He's talking again about excess, taking that which should be pleasurable, the first drink, maybe the second drink, and going to excess to the point where it's no longer communal, and we're having a good time, and we're talking together and having some fun. It now becomes destructive. I don't like your looks. And a third, means the fourth drink, really, drowns him. The sea image. You lose your personality altogether. You're gone. bonk, you fall off the bar stool. You're gone. You're dead to the world. And as anyone knows who has ever had to deal with a serious alcoholic, it is drowning. It is the loss of personality. It is death. It is the wisdom of the fool. Okay? But notice how Shakespeare connects it with the sea image that's in the play. Because what you are doing by giving into any excess to that point, to that degree, is destroying yourself. The self is lost. The self is gone. And Olivia says to the fool, go thou and seek the coroner and let him sit on my cuz, for he is in the third degree of drink. He's drowned. Go look after him. The clown says, he is but mad yet, Madonna. No, he's not gone yet. There is hope. He is but mad yet, Madonna, and the fool shall look to the madman. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And he goes off to tend to Sir Toby. Okay. Now, please notice, in scene two of the play, we have a character who has survived drowning. And I hope at this point it should become clear to you why the danger that Viola has faced and overcome, and we will learn her brother Sebastian did the same thing, is drowning. They have faced an excess of water. They have faced an excess of danger. They have come face to face with death and survived it. They have made it to dry land. In a way, we have to take that as an image of the stability of both Viola and Sebastian. And not only that, Viola, beautiful, beautiful character. Oh, man, I love her. I wish she was real. One might not have been an old bachelor. But she comes on and says, what country, friends, is this? And the captain says, this is Illyria, lady. And she says, and what should I do in Illyria? I just survived drowning. I just lost my brother. I'm in a strange country. What do I do? My brother, he is in Elysium. He was a good man. I hope he's in heaven. Please notice the parallel to Lady Olivia. For Viola, it's just a simple statement. Perchance he is not drowned. What do you think, sailors? Perchance he is not drowned. There is hope in her. Hope is a virtue. She arrives on shore and she's modest, she's hopeful, and aside from the fact, I don't know where I am, her next thought is her brother. The other, not herself, the other. It is perchance that you yourself were saved. Well, you were saved, maybe your brother was saved. Oh, my poor brother, and so perchance may he be. It's just simple and beautiful. There is not excess here, okay? There's not excess. Now, well, what do I do? What do I do? Where do I go? Who rules here? Oh, Orsino. Orsino, I've heard my father name him. He was a bachelor then. So is now, or was so very late. For but a month ago I went from hence, and then it was fresh in murmur, as you know, that he did... I love this. What great ones do, the less will prattle of. I love it. He did seek the love of fair Olivia. So everybody knows about it. What she? And then we get the little story, a virtuous maid. She is virtuous. But she's forsworn the sight of men. Okay. Viola's response is, oh, that I served that lady and might not be delivered to the world till I'd made mine own occasion mellow what my estate is. I don't know where I am. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I can survive here. I'm in a strange land. She's a virtuous lady. She's lost her father and her brother. I wish I could serve her. What comes first to Viola's mind is not, boy, I'm in trouble. What am I going to do? Who's going to help me? It's, boy, I don't know where I am or what I'm going to do. I wish I could be of service to a virtuous lady till I figure out what I'm going to do. the other. And thy neighbor as thyself. Viola obviously loves herself. She tried to save herself. She came to shore. But she is more concerned in serving someone she doesn't know that she trusts is virtuous. That were hard to compass, the captain says, because she will admit no kind of suit, not the Duke's. You can't get into her. She's sealed off. So she then says, well, I'll pay thee bounteously, conceal me what I am, be my aid for such disguise as haply shall become the form of my intent. I'll serve this Duke. Can't serve the lady, I'll serve the Duke. Service. The other. But to conceal herself, and it makes sense why she's doing it, she's in a strange land. She's a woman alone, a young woman alone in a strange land, okay? Thou shalt present me as a eunuch to him. This is very interesting. There are 5 Shakespeare plays in which we have young women disguised as men, okay? He uses the device over and over again in his comedies. 2 Gentlemen of Verona, The Merchant of Venice, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, and Cymbeline at the end of his career. Now, there was a reason for this. Again, there was a practical reason for this in terms of the stage. Just as when we got a new comic member to the company, the kind of comic role he wrote shifted. There was a stage purpose here. No women were allowed on the stage. No woman appeared on any stage anywhere until the year 1660. The Puritans closed the theaters from 1642 to 1660. When they reopened, actresses were allowed on the stage for the first time. Until that point, there had never been a woman who appeared on the stage, ever, anywhere. Okay? So what you had was a young boy actor playing a young girl. That was the tradition. Nobody saw anything weird in it. It's just the way it was done. You took a young boy because the voice hadn't changed yet. He's small. And there could be a hint of the feminine, so he played the girl's roles. Shakespeare must have had an extraordinary boy actor. We don't know his name. Have no record of him. He had to have been brilliant, and so brilliant that as he grew older, Shakespeare kept him in the company and kept writing roles for him. What's the history of it? He obviously started with Julia or Portia, played Beatrice, played Rosalind, played Viola, then played Ophelia, then played Desdemona, then played probably Goneril in King Lear, then played Lady Macbeth, then played Cleopatra, and then played Volumnia in Coriolanus, a mother's role. As the boy got older, Shakespeare wrote older women's parts for him and challenged him. Yeah, kid, I'm a brand new play for you. You're going to play the wife of the King of Scotland. What this means, a superb... I'm writing a role for you. You've heard of her. Her name's Cleopatra. Okay? This young man had to have been a brilliant actor so that he could convey the feminine. Now, what we get, of course, is a boy actor playing a girl on stage who disguises herself as a boy. Nowadays, because everybody out there in the critical world and in literature departments are all crazy, it's all about gender mixing. And it's really about queer theory. And it's about the fact that nobody has any gender and everybody's chasing her. No. What it has to do with is the simple fact, one, he's doing a favor for the boy, so that for much of the play, the boy can pretend to be a boy, a girl, well, you know. I won't go through it every time. But there's something beyond that. There is the notion that there is something above the sexual. that there are whole areas of human relationship far beyond the sexual. When Viola says, I'm going to become a eunuch, now when she goes to the court, she's just a boy. But the reference to the eunuch takes us to Matthew 19, verse 12. For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men. And there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. There are some who are born that way. There are some that men make that way, the poor castrati who were snipped, because they might have a good voice. Thousands of them. And maybe one could sing. And there are those who become eunuchs. What is St. Paul saying? He's saying there are those who deny their sexual nature and do not go to women or the opposite sex for the higher good. And in a sense, anyone who is unmarried is called to the life of chastity and in one sense becomes a eunuch. I.e., not a sexual participant in the world the way that most men and women are in marriage or when they sin, which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, for a higher good, for a religious good. Viola says she's going to become a eunuch. And it's a clear echo of that. How do we know it's an echo of that? Because the same passage is echoed elsewhere in the play. Some are born eunuchs. Some become eunuchs. Some, remember the lines of Malvolio when he's reading the letter. Some are born great. Some achieve greatness. And some have greatness thrust upon them. The structure of the phrase echoes the Gospel of St. Matthew. Shakespeare has it in mind. But of course what's happening there, the echo is, what Malvolio is after is the marriage to Olivia so that he can elevate himself. What Viola is after in disguising herself as a boy is protecting and preserving herself so she can serve until she discovers who she is and where she is and how she's to live. Very different things. Very different things. So she goes and she serves the Duke Orsino. Okay? And here's a mystery. People have talked about this probably from the time the play was first produced. She falls in love with him. The simple fact of the matter is, not many like the guy. He's full of himself. We've just gone through what he's like. Why on earth does Viola fall in love with this guy? And Shakespeare's answer, I think, would be a very simple one. It's the only answer we can give. There's no understanding the ways of the heart. And maybe she thinks she can make him a better man. She does. She does by the end. Or maybe she sees something in him that nobody else can see. God bless her. Or maybe it's part of the sacrifice she's going to make in loving a man that is not the most honorable, greatest, best man in the world, but boy, he's better off with Viola than he is with anybody else. She falls in love with him. And he sends her as an emissary to Olivia. Now, here's another curiosity for you. Orsino has his court. Olivia has her house. That's where the whole play is set. And only two characters go back and forth between the two houses. Orsino is trapped in his house. Olivia will not leave her house. And the house becomes an image of a prison. And if the ego, the self, the me, the excessive self-love becomes a kind of trap, these characters are trapped where they dwell. The only characters who have a measure of freedom and can move freely in the world back and forth Between the two houses are Viola and Festy the Clown, the two who know who they are. And that image of the house as prison comes back when Malvolio, who seems to have become a madman, wearing yellow stockings, cross-gartered, coming to his mistress, smiling. She thinks he's gone nuts. He's crazy. And because he's crazy, they lock him away in a dark house. His punishment is to be docked, and he complains when Festy comes to see him. They have locked me in this dark house, he says. And Festy says, there is no darkness but ignorance. And Malvolio has not known who he is. The image of the house you can't break out of, your own house as prison, is everywhere in the play, and it's appropriate. It's appropriate, okay? And Malvolio is the one who gets punished most. He is in a dark house. It is a prison. And that's where he finds himself. Viola goes as an ambassador for the Duke to see Olivia. Says, now please notice, again, you want selflessness? She's fallen in love with the guy. What's she doing? Wooing someone else on his behalf because he loves this woman. We're talking selflessness. Total selflessness. How does he love me? Olivia asks. With adorations, with fertile tears, with groans that thunder love, with sighs of fire. Your lord does know my mind. I cannot love him. Yet I suppose him virtuous, know him noble, of great estate, of fresh and stainless youth, in voices well divulged, free, learned, and valiant, and in dimension and the shape of nature, a gracious person. But yet I cannot love him. He might have took his answer long ago. Viola says, if I did love you in my master's flame with such a suffering, such a deadly life, in your denial I would find no sense. I would not understand it. Why, what would you? This poetry is so great. Forgive me for spoiling it with words, my voice. What would you? Make me a willow cabin at your gate? And call upon my soul within the house. Write loyal cantons of contemned love, and sing them loud even in the dead of night. Hallow your name to the reverberate hills, and make the babbling gossip of the air cry out, Olivia! Oh, you should not rest between the elements of air and earth, but you should pity me. Whereupon, Olivia falls in love with Viola, the boy. Well, who wouldn't? Oh, man. Look at the passage. It's on page 100 in your book. I want to go through it in some detail. This is pure Shakespeare. This is the great dramatist, the great poet. This is, oh, my, oh, my. What would you? Make me a willow cabin at your gates. Please notice, I will not enter your house. And we know what the house means, okay? I would not, I am only worthy to be at the edge of your property. I'll just come to the gate. And since I know I can't enter in there, thank you, I can't enter in there and I can't leave you, what I will do is make me a willow cabin. You have a grand house, a grand estate. I'm only worthy of a little cabin. I'll build my own. I'll make it of willow. What is willow? The weeping tree. It seems hopeless. I'm going to make my cabin out of willow, the weeping willow, the tree of sorrow. But I won't cry because I'm going to be there. You won't be able to move me. Although a willow cabin, whoosh, not real sturdy, but the notion is, well, I guess I'll build another one. Make me a willow cabin at your gate and call upon my soul within the house. Oh, I love it. Oh, Viola is not trapped within the self. She says, if I were in love, my soul would dwell in the other. I would reach out. I would give my soul. I would know my soul was out there in your house, not in my house, not in my willow cabin. What I would do is call upon my soul within the house, write loyal cantons of contemned love. By the way, look at these sentences. Make, call, write, sing. Shakespeare's got action verb, action verb, action verb, action verb. I won't just sit and listen to music and go, oh, I'm so sad. I won't just walk around and go, oh, my brother's dead. Action, 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 even if I knew it was hopeless. Write loyal cantons of contemned love. Now, I know you're going to reject them. I know you're going to throw them back at me. But they're going to be loyal, and I'm going to keep writing them. Write loyal cantons of contemned love and sing them loud even in the dead of night. Very different from the drunken song of Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, and Feste in the middle of the night in the house, which they're singing for their own amusement and fun and waking everybody. No, I will sing cantons of love to you even in the dead of night. The night may be dead, but I will bring it alive with my song of love. Hallow your name to the reverberant hills. I'll let the whole world know how wonderful you are. The whole world will know about you. And I'll sing it to the hills because they're going to echo it all around. The reverberant hills. And you think this guy just wrote it. How did he do this? How did he do this? And make the babbling gossip of the air cry out, Olivia. The air echoing is like gossips who are just talking endlessly, but all the air will say is, Olivia, 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 Olivia. Whee! Oh, you should not rest between the elements of air and earth, but you should pity me. Notice, not you should love me, but what? You would just feel sorry that I'm in this state.